This is Thomas Potler, September 28, 1990, The Mind-Body Connection.
Good evening, everybody. I have the pleasure here of introducing our guest speaker, Thomas Potler, MD, and Sharon Burroughs, who won't be speaking tonight, but she will be tomorrow at the seminar. Sharon has come down from Vancouver. Tom is going to be speaking on a healing image, and seeing as I see as you're reading this, I'm going to just turn it right over to him.
Actually, the healing image is going to be tomorrow. That's the workshop. Tonight is healing the mind-body connection. The format that I'm going to be doing is to talk to you for 30 or 40 minutes and have some slides, take a little break, and then come back. And I've got a few cases that I'd like to tell you about out of my practice that I think help some of this come together, and then have some questions. In terms of references to this material, I think that Ernest Rossi's book, The Psychobiology of Mind-Body Healing, is a really good, solid book. Rossi's a Jungian analyst and a pharmacologist, studied with Milton Erickson, and he's really got a good base for looking at mind-body connections. Anthony Stevens, who's a Jungian analyst, has a book called Archetypes, Natural History of the Self, which gets into some of the areas I'm going to talk about. And in terms of nuts and bolts, mind-body therapy, I think Ron Kurtz, the Hakomi founder, has a book called Body-Centered Psychotherapy, which is good as I've seen in terms of working. To me, Jung's most helpful contribution involved three main areas in terms of what I do, which is trying to look at psyche in various illnesses. And the first of these is the concept that mind-body or psyche-soma, spirit-matter, were not separate, not regarded as separated by Jung, but were a spectrum. And to quote Jung, they were one and the same life. So psyche and soma were seen as opposite ends extending from the physiological to the psychological. Jung didn't fall prey to Descartesian dualism, which resulted in the so-called mind-body split. And that's contributed, the mind-body split has contributed to our dilemma of a medicine that can't deal with the psyche and the psychiatry that can't deal with the body. That's sort of a dilemma that we're in there. Although there are some major shifts occurring, and many of them from alternative care areas. Now, the second area of view that has helped me is his attitude, was his attitude toward the unconscious. Instead of seeing the unconscious as a wasteland, Jung was passionately interested in the healing aspects of unconscious material. Neuroses, psychoses, delusional ideas were seen as a potential need or drive to create new meaning for the individual and to have healing potential. Unconscious material would represent split off ideas that were denied or repressed and were balanced as one-sided. Now, if we combine these first two items or areas, I think you can come up with something really interesting. In other words, if psyche and soma are opposite ends of the same spectrum, and we're going to say that disturbances of psyche have great meaning in terms of the individual, what about disturbances of the body? Can we say that symptoms, illnesses, diseases, physical traumas can also have the same kind of significance? Now, another unique concept, that of the conquest, has helped me in terms of mind-body approach to physical things. And the complex is perhaps the most elusive term to slip into our everyday vernacular. It's very well used. And the idea that our complexes use us is a little less entertaining. I find it incredible the way some of these areas sneak into things like movies and television. I'm sure many of you don't spend much time watching Miami Vice, but this is a detective show that used to be on quite regularly Friday night. Prototype heroes are two Vice Squad detectives who go around breaking up very South American drug cartels. And this particular night, they're looking over the modus operandi of a criminal who just attacks and robs older men. And the more cerebral Tubbs says, well, he must have some kind of father problem. And the less cerebral Crockett says, yeah, something like that. So I think if Crockett and Tubbs know about the complex, I think that we can pretty well ascertain that it's into our language and it's into our culture. Now, the idea of the complex as an autonomous psychic process with a certain feeling tone or emotion to it was Jung's first major contribution on behalf of all schools of analysis. And Jung formulated the complex theory from a variety of sources, including work with his mediumistic cousin. In 1903, he began his research at the University Clinic in Zurich, and he did not think up, but he perfected and became highly proficient at the word association test. This test provided the experimental foundation for any kind of psychoanalytical approach. Now, the original setup of this test was a simple list of 100 words that was read to a patient by an instructor. And a fifth of a second stopwatch measured reaction time between when the word was given and the patient's response. So that was the basic setup, is to see how long it took the patient to come up with a word to another word. Now, besides just a prolonged reaction time, there were other indicators that there might be something going on with the meaning of this word for the patient. And that could include stuttering or not hearing, in other words, huh? You say that again. Meaningless replies, responses in a foreign tongue. Now, after the initial test, sometimes the patient was asked to repeat as many words as they could remember that they were given. And it was found that complex indicator words, in other words, words that had a lot of juice to them, that made the person stutter, forget, or ask to say it again, couldn't be remembered by the person. And that's where we're going to come into that aspect of how the complex is a disturber of memory, how that relates to some things that are thought about now. Also, the words that came before and after complex indicated words couldn't be remembered either. So, in other words, if I've got something about dog, I might not remember the cat and carrot preceded and postceded the word dog. So, thus, the mere hearing of complex indicator word was enough to produce a disturbance or an altered state of consciousness. Now, later on, certain mechanical devices were added to the test, allowing the physiological measure of respiration, pulse, and robotic skin response, in other words, sweating. And that these were other indicators of complex indicators. In other words, if you managed to get the word out quick enough, up, but the respirations changed, and the pulse shot up from 80 to 120, where you started to sweat like everything. These were also became complex indicators. Now, this is the first time that there was an experiment that demonstrated the presence of autonomous disturbances of consciousness capable of creating alterations in both mind and body. And that's why I regard Jung as one of the fathers of mind-body connection, and these things are extremely important. Of course, these complex indicator tests later on became the basis of the lie detector test, which is not incriminating evidence, at least the admissible evidence now for the law. Now, I'm going to leave Jung for a while here, and I'm going to take you into the world of Tom Potlerism here, and I don't want you to confuse the two. But in considering the mind-body connection, it's helpful to view our brains as not just one, but three distinct interconnected organs. If I can have the first slide. Our brain is an evolutionary structure. We started out with the reptile brain. We start with the reptile for now. It's also known as the brain stem. And it's got our vital centers in it, like breathing, respiration, and a lot of survival instincts. Snakes, alligators, lizards, frogs, quite a bit. They mainly react. They run away, they attack, they don't translate things from meaning, and they don't have a lot of emotions other than perhaps quite a lot. If a human is left with the brain scan, they're sort of a coma or vegetative state. They have withdrawal reflexes, sticking the pain, that's about it. Now, above this, it's also called the emotional brain. So this is going to be an important concept, as well as nerve connections. The limbic system is now sort of seen as a mass of hormones and hormone-making areas. Above that is the neomyelinating cerebral cortex, in other words, the left and right cerebral hemispheres. This is the way our brains evolved. And this might be a little bit dry, but if you want to see this in another way, you could just sort of imagine a totem pole concept where you might have an alligator at the bottom. Brain and the tiger representing the limbic system, and maybe a football player representing the cerebral cortex. We have the next slide, please. So, we've got Mr. Alligator and Mr. Tiger and this fellow here, Mr. Bosworth, who has every right to be up there and have just gotten his $500 disability insurance tax free. I actually made this slide about 6 or 7 years ago before one of the world of Boz came into being. It's going out of Oklahoma, but it's remained timely in Seattle. So, in talking about the mind body, it's important trying to define what exactly I'm talking about. And I'm not going to try to define mind, but I'm going to define it this way. To me, the mind-body connection is a process whereby external events are encoded into the physiology of the body. And if we can just kind of take that as such, that's one of the how an external event becomes encoded in physiology. Now, next slide. And this is what I mean by the mind-body connection in sort of graphic terms. And really, we've got our same picture here. Vase up there in blue. Red is the tiger brain of the system. Green is the snake brain. Extending down from it, upside down Y, is the autonomic nervous system, which is essentially a nervous system that goes on without any thinking, stimulating part called the sympathetic and a slowing down part called the parasympathetic. Now, over here on this slide is the inferior peptide system, which are a number of hormones that are made by all the different organs of the body. In other words, the immune system is cranking out peptides, the gut's cranking out peptides, the pancreas, the renal glands are cranking out peptides, and the vascular system. The heart makes hormones that communicates with similar hormones and receptors in the brain. If you want to go further, the main producers of these peptides actually correspond to areas that are chakra centers. I don't know if that's connected or not, but it strikes me as being more than coincidental. And these work in sort of feedback loops, and the yellow area in the limbic system there is the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is really the king of the brain because it's got two different kinds of cells. It can go either way. Switch hitter, it can make hormones or it can make neurotransmitters. So let's take a major event of maybe getting a pony for your fifth birthday or something. So here's the event over here, and it comes in through the sense organ. Actually, we're using the eye, but of course the experience can come in through all kinds of sense organs. And there's a brief stop in the limbic system, and then it's jetted up to the cerebral cortex, and there it's processed for meaning. In other words, the cerebral cortex makes some judgment calls on what's this mean? Is this good? Is this bad? Is this exciting? And then from the cerebral cortex, it goes back down to the limbic system into the hypothalamus, where it's processed with the peptide system and with the autonomic nervous system. So I get excited, my heart begins to laugh, I jump up and down, I have all these emotions of joy with this pony, and I get off my pony and catch a spur, and I smell the pony all ponies. And all these things together make sort of and when I think about this experience, if I think about it hard, I can kind of get back into that state. I can remember that birthday cake, kiss the pain, I remember that horse, I remember my dad, and I can be glad, excited, and my body reacts. And so it's all tied up in sort of a nice tape. And so what I'm saying is that memory can be much more than just a thought or an association. In the strongly active realm, memory can include sensations, emotions, and activation of these various pre-recorded peptide programs. In other words, maybe my pulse will go up. My blood pressure will go up when I think about certain experiences. This entire sequence kind of recreates the psychophysiological experience that we recall. Now, memory can be activated by a similar external event. Every time I have a birthday party for one of my kids, I can kind of remember how I felt. Or I can just think about that birthday party, and I can get that experience again. And you know, you can consider this yourself, your body's response to thinking of your favorite food, and the salivation that comes, your bodily or emotional responses to a memory of being shamed as a child. That's a little more unpleasant. Or on the brighter side of things, your bodily response by thinking of your lustiest encounter, or your lustiest encounter yet. So you see that the mind-body connection goes on all the time. And you think, well, what's the problem? Well, there is a problem, and that has to do with when we're traumatized, that things don't quite work the same way. Freud initially based the etiology of hysteria on unrecognized childhood abuse, called seduction. He exuberantly claimed to have discovered the psychological source of denial, which I think is a very nice phrase. However, he presented this material to his peer community in Vienna and was sort of booed off the stage, in a sense. The world really wasn't ready to pour that yet. And so Freud then went over to different concepts, including the Oedipus complex and other intrapsychic conflicts. That's sort of part of psychoanalytical theory right now. Now, Jung, however, consistently stuck with the complex theory and described the complex as the royal road to the unconscious. And I'm going to be getting around to how I relate the complex theory to this. Old traumas are again recognized as sources of current psychological problems, but the concept that the same experiences can lead to new body problems is less well known, although it is coming into the consciousness world. Now, if we take our model here, we remember this is sort of a base model of a traumatic event, or of a mind-body connection, how things normally go, and we substitute a traumatic event for this normal event, certain things happen. And if we have the next slide happen, we'll talk about that. Now, you'll notice that there's a switch here. We've got a traumatic event. And we sort of recognize that pupil on the eye is dilated and big. And we'll notice that instead of this information going up to the cerebral cortex here, the VOD here is knocked out of the play. There's a big X here. And in cases of severe trauma, there's a nucleus in that snake brain called the locus coeruleus that sort of takes up the command center. And this center, a little yellow thing in the green brain there, contains most of the norepinephrine in the brain. So when that is activated, it sends out a tremendous burst, a real jolt of norepinephrine. It wakes up the little tiger in the limbic system, and it alerts the being, the organism, that this is a fight, flight, or freeze situation. Now, this phenomenon called transduction, which the hypothalamus does, still occurs. In other words, we still get changes to the peptide system, and we still get changes downward to the autonomic nervous system. But, as we remember, the boss has been carried out on a stretcher here, and he doesn't know what happened. In other words, we dissociate. I used to think of dissociation as a psychological term, but but it's really a physiologic return. So here's where that absence of consciousness comes into play. When we're getting caught in one of our complexes. I think most of us know how we feel. Wait a second here, there's something not right. In a minimal way, in a bigger way, we can completely go out. So we end up then, instead of meet with meaning, we end up with a symptom. And these symptoms then can be in a variety of ways. Transduction still occurs in the memory of the body is responding to the event. So we can get mental symptoms, we can get physical symptoms, developmental symptoms, or behaviors. Let's go to the next slide. Now here's something that the event comes on and it just stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system, which controls the gut. And this is a picture that the patient drew for me who has irritable colons. And every time she gets in a situation where she gets stressed or memories are not quite conscious, then the gut cramps. And this is a good drawing of the symptoms. You can see that all the energy, all the juice here down in the gut, you have the people in their eyes, is kind of bland. So one of the things we can do is this symptom is almost like the sixth sense. And she can use this in a way to get in tune with what's going on. Next slide. Now, this is an example of developmental things. Any ideas on how old this little girl is? Okay. She's really 8. She came out of a family severely abusive. She has seen growth structure and development of 4-year-old. She's really 8. And this is an example of something called psychosocial dwarfism or maternal deprivations. She was admitted to the hospital with her growth hormone levels, which is a pituitary hormone, should have been really high. And they weren't. They were very low, almost non-existent. After 3 months in a soothing environment, she had a big growth spurt and the hormone levels went back up. So that's developmental. The next one. No. Well, it's a case out of Germany that I extracted. And as far as I know, she began to make her own. She was not given by the children. Now, next slide. These are the headlines from about 6 months ago from a fellow on death row in California, and they struck me as a behavioral consequence problem. And this is not uncommon in looking at criminals and murderers, that they have just these absolutely horrible childhoods that seem to put these bad tapes in and play off. Alice Miller's done a devoted chapter to Hitler's childhood and For Your Own Good, I think it's the name of the book. Now, So, this concept of experiencing a traumatic event might be conceptualized as creating a software program, but it's a rogue program. A rogue program whose existence remains unknown to normal consciousness. Because of the rogue program's own connections and protein nature of the peptide system, in other words, it can go just up to any organ system. Any organ system can be created. When external events resembling in any way the original trauma or experience, the rogue program would have to be laid out. And that's one way it happens. In other words, something happens, found a traumatic event, and it just knocked off our feet while we're riding through the throngs or tumbles. Now, however, just plain overwhelming stress of any kind enough to sort of have a physiological regression, we can start getting into a complex. In other words, it's a stress that you start having high blood pressure or gut problems. And if this goes on repeatedly, what can this lead to? Now, can this lead to chronic disease? Can this lead to disturbances in the immune system? Can this lead to cancerous change, which takes a long time? I think there's a good possibility. Now, there are other ways that this can happen. Remember that we've got a right and left cerebral hemisphere, and every once in a while you see someone at the grocery store, a parent, got the little child, and the child is acting up, and mom or dad says, well, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you, and they give, with a smile on their face, they give the child a whack. Well, what does this do? Well, the right brain takes in the whole picture. See the smiling face. The right brain takes into attention the whole gestalt thing. The left brain, all of a sudden, knows that it's being whacked. And so there's a split in consciousness. There's a dissociation. Consequently, say a child is continually subjected to these double messages, these minor traumas that don't think any of them. These can cause these memories to form. A little example of that is I was in an ice cream parlor and had an ice cream cone, and there was across the room was maybe a little 3 or 4 year old boy, and he was obviously having his first ice cream. First ice cream cone is kind of a mystery. You try to handle it the best way you can. And, of course, the things being what they are, a four-year-old, he started to eat it from the bottom. It seemed like the right thing to do. It looked pretty good to me. But I was watching mom and dad, too. And dad was laughing. And mom was saying, don't do that. And, of course, there we lost our cone. It's a small example of how confusing these messages can be to children, and how important child development is overwhelmingly. And of course, we've got other behavioral conditions such as phobia, fear of open spaces, fear of closed spaces. They may all be related to traumatic events. And of course, there's all kinds of overlap in these categories. Panic attacks that are frequently seen. They've got psychological symptoms, they've got physiological symptoms, they've got behavioral symptoms with them. The whole concept of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is still a big problem for our Vietnam vets, consists of a wide variety of mental, physical, behavioral manifestations. Now, when we look at experiences that can be considered traumatic, it's tremendously wide. I mean, you think bad things happen to us, but trauma is so ubiquitous. And it can depend on age, family factors. It may or may not depend on culture. I think that's controversial. and what shape you are physically and mentally, and what age you are when you're traumatized. Now, great concern to me, coming from a family practice of medicine background, is the traumatic quality of illness, injuries, and aspects of medical care, including anesthesia, surgery, and the post-operative period. All of these medical-related situations have associated potential and they hinder the healing process and it can lead to future illnesses. Next slide. This is our physician here, Dr. Freddy, and we'll make him into a surgeon. And Dr. Freddy wears a mask with the physician guides his line, and he drives his car, which has the license plates 007, and he works at his state surgery clinic on Elm Street. And Dr. Freddy doesn't recognize the risks that come to people when they're ill, and how illness itself is often called the state. Even if you come into to the physician with the flu, the temperature of 104, you're just not the same person that you are when you're on your feet. And I've got a lot of examples from my practice where I look for these things. Not just, I don't just take a history of illnesses, but what happened, what kind of experience did you have with your surgery. And I find things like this all the time. A lady came in and she had taken her dog to fetch, and another little dog had jumped out a window and was literally hanging from its leash, and she grabbed this little dog and saved it, but the dog was obviously having a traumatic memory here and nipped her lip. And so this lady needed stitches to just kind of approximate this. This was a Saturday morning a few years back. And so I told her what I was going to do, and everything seemed great. And about the time I put a small drape over her face and put the Novocaine in, she began to hyperventilate. Well, you know, I mean, I'm just a doc here, and I thought it was just hyperventilation or it was just the trauma of this suturing thing, and I was thinking about maybe having to give her a shot, but I looked down, and her hands, even though her body was trying to get out of there, her hands were tightly grasping the operating table. And so I just kind of stepped back, and I asked her, well, what are your hands doing? And at that point, she says, they're holding me down. She says, I'm going to have a C-section, and they're beginning things, and my arms are tied down and I can't fight. And so this little trauma, which may not be so little, had triggered this memory, and her arms were still being held down there. Well, we went over that scenario and we got things calmed down. We didn't need any Valium. We got the lip sutured up, and of course I got a little case. So everybody was happy. There's a couple other things about just what trauma can be, geographic moves. Remember when we got jerked out of a school or had to leave our friends or our friends left us. The loss of siblings, grandparents, significant loved ones. Exposure to illness. Did one of your siblings, were they ever really sick or had to go to the hospital? What were your ideas about when Brother Johnny went to the hospital with scarlet fever? Did you think he was going to come back? Did someone say something? Did you think he was going to die? Were you allowed to go see him in those days? Could little kids go to the hospital? Oftentimes they couldn't. 15, 20 years ago, little kids couldn't go to the hospital. Did you see accidents or deaths or shifts in the family system, divorces, prolonged absence? History of addictive behavior or substance abuse, and these are all traumatic influences that can influence things on a mind-body level. Now, so far, I'm going to recap this. Our discussion has taken us to the concept of traumatic experiences of a wide variety and cause of the psychophysiological condition of dissociation. In other words, our cerebral cortex that nature's worked so hard to place up there, calling the shots on everything, can be knocked out of the picture. Now, this entire sequence of varying degrees is unknown to our ordinary ego consciousness, i.e., we are amnesic regarding the actual event. Now, subsequent experiences, which have some sort of similarity to the key traumatic event, may rekindle the program, the rote program, along with its sequel, mental, physical, developmental, or behavioral symptoms. Now, initially, if we're going to talk about mind-body therapy, in other words, how do we do this? How do we treat something that I don't know exists and the patient doesn't know exists, or that if I go to somebody, I don't know what's wrong, either it is he or she. Since the traumatic event was shielded from consciousness in the first place, but that basically is kind of a protective function. I mean, that short-circuiting is protective in a sense. Its rediscovery would depend on re-entering a state containing material that is frightful, painful, or in other ways threatening to a patient. Another way of expressing this is to say the traumatic memory is a state-dependent memory. That's a big word these days. Recall of the traumatic event is prevented unless a person would re-enter the particular state of consciousness the traumatic event took place in. And this state of memory is held incommunicado from higher consciousness. The memory will not be reproduced unless there's a significant internal or external experience to arouse it or to rekindle it. Now, if I can have the next slide. Now, how about anybody maybe move? Pardon me? No. It's in that era, though. This is City Life. Of course, we've got Charlie Chaplin here. And in the movie, Charlie is befriended the blind woman. And he's actually out trying to get some money to help her get better. There's something that he is out one night and he comes across a drunk millionaire. Well, the millionaire is all chuckles and happy and loquacious and friendly and takes Charlie home and finds the dying room. Next morning, the millionaire sobers up and he has no memory at all of who Charlie is and kicks him out. The next night, Charlie's making the rounds again. The millionaire, again drunk, recognizes Charlie as a long-lost friend, takes him home again, winds and dies, and then the next morning he's able to get him out again. So this is an example of a state-dependent phenomenon. Now, fortunately, there's a link between the state-dependent memory, this rogue program that we're talking about, or I'm going to go all the way here, conscious and unconscious. And you said that somewhere. But it's the symptom can be seen as the tail of the state. So as such, the symptom amounts to sort of a defense or protective mechanism against the full re-experience of a previous traumatic memory. In other words, a little bit of it breaks through in my gut, but not all of it. I'm not ready for all of it. I may never be ready. Now, on the other hand, the symptom can be viewed as an attempt at healing by the psyche. In other words, since we are self-healing by nature, if I cut myself, I don't have to tell my cells, my fibroblasts, to start healing. So the psyche also is self-healing. And the state-dependent memory sort of acts like a foreign body. And the symptom, metaphorically at least, is like psychological separation. In other words, it's in there and it's really trying to get out, and it really wants us to remember and heal from this. Theoretically, by starting with a symptom, such as certain cases of abdominal pain, the therapist will be able to backtrack so you know that the abdominal pain is a result of stimulation by the parasympathetic nervous system. So you can go from symptom, the tummy ache, to the parasympathetic nervous system, to the state of memory, and sort of unravel. Now that's the ideal technique. I'm not going to say that happens often, but it's a possible mechanism of how this works. I have the next slide. So, here is an example of format for one of my therapies. You go from a symptom, and if the symptom is related to the state-dependent memory, then the state-dependent memory is sort of semi-conscious. If you increase the symptom a little bit, instead, in other words, if I increase that abdominal pain a little bit the person is having, instead of trying to make it all go away, maybe the person will, and maybe we'll get into some energy, some memories, some doubt, some meanings in connection with some old traumas. Now, there are various techniques that men use in reframing, which is a phrase about narratives, the memory and the experience, and then representing the whole experience with a cerebral cortex. In other words, you've got to go back and say, that's okay. You start recalling, you start having emotions, and you then represent the whole thing. And then the cerebral cortex helps you out, go, now I understand it. And go back down to the system, you retranslate it, and you make a new series, a new peptide. Appropriate body responses. Now this is somewhat similar, but it does happen as well. Well, I think that if the process may be the same, but the information gain is not as great in the sense of the So in other words, we're putting a new tape on the cerebral cortex that has good physiology, healthy peptides. In other words, a user-friendly protein. Because of the ubiquitous nature of the peptide communication system, almost any organ system can be conceived of the input. First slide of the vascular system possibly includes all these. Well, okay, this sounds pretty good. And is it the source of the knot? Well, I think it's one of the tributaries, and a pretty strong tributary, if you'll allow me to indulge myself. But there are pitfalls in doing this. I'll just tell you how. The patient must be in a personal place where the defensive function of the symptom is ready to yield to the healing function. In other words, the patient has really got to be in that place where they're willing to go. Because I mean, I'm telling them, well, let's make your headache go worse. They say, well, you know, where'd you go to school? Something like that. There's a possibility of activating profound states of anger, sadness, and various paranormal phenomena. that the therapist must have time and experience to perform. Now, the painful material, like the state-dependent memory, is ours in our own business. So in other words, Mr. Tiger said we're in the realm of emotional brain. So all bets are off in terms of what you might get. Representing painful material containing the state of memory must take into consideration that the right cerebral cortex has got a language comprehension of about a 5-year-old. Now, I, in other words, when I work with people on this, I explain it to them like they're about 5 years old. And really, the cerebral cortex of the right hemisphere, that's the language ability that it has. And I think a lot of therapies that work with dealing with a child, things like that, are related to this because they're dealing directly with the right brain. Now, here's another problem. There's rarely a single trauma as the source of the symptom, but rather an onion skin effect. And this is quite Jungian in terms of Red Whitman's book. He describes the complex onion that it's got skin after skin, and there may be a physical trauma, emotional trauma, a medical trauma, a birth trauma, and various other almost karmic, genetic karmic traumas like past life phenomena that are buried in their suffering. And that is why I feel that individuals who have these problems almost always require a multidisciplinary approach with support from various sections of the health professions. And this is where this intersection is occurring. That now I can send people to a massage therapist, or I can use a chiropractor, and a chiropractor would refer me patients, and movement therapists, and psychotherapists, and occasionally, I prescribe some medication and it goes in this moment, replacing it's well replaced melanin. And it really helps to have a team approach for these kind of things. And some traumas just don't come out in words. They just come out in emotional states, come out in pain, and the patient never really has an intellectual understanding of their trauma. They just know that something happened, they've had their release, and it's apparent. Now, well, you can see I like the movies, and thank you. Somebody's got to know who this guy is. Yes, RoboCop, right. And RoboCop is played by the actor Peter Wellen. It's directed by a man named Paul Vanderhoeven. And here's a really wonderful scene in her that is not as wonderful as the movie, but to preface this, there's a police officer named Murphy, who is shot up real bad by a bunch of real shadowy characters. And he's, instead of just being let die, which should have happened, he's seized by only corporation products, and he's made into a cyborg. In other words, he still has some human parts, but he's mostly machine. He's got a computer for a brain. And he starts cleaning up Detroit. And it's a big job, and he does a nice job of it. But somehow, he gets an idea that there's something a little fishy here, this idea that he doesn't have a memory about anything. And he plugs himself into the computer, and he finds out that he had a name, Murphy. And he goes to his old house, and his family's been told he's been dead. Only corporations take care of all the loose ends here. And he looks at the fireplace, he looks at the crumpled picture, and he goes back to his police department, and his partner, who's a woman, says, Murphy, could you remember And Murphy said, I can't remember, but I can feel. And that's the mind-body connection, too. And it's also worth checking out for that. I want to... One little case vignette. I see people oftentimes for the first time for walk-in problems in my immediate care clinic. I see a lot of minor things, and I just hadn't seen this person before. I walked in, and the complaint was abdominal pain. And I didn't know the person. I saw they didn't have a fever. And I walked into the room, and there was about a 30-year-old fellow there, and he looked angry. And that was sort of my first clue. And he was sort of moving around, and his tummy was hurting, and he'd been vomiting. And he was just difficult. He wanted to be better. He wanted to be better quick. He wanted to know what was wrong. And I checked him. At first, I thought he might even have appendicitis because he was just hurting so bad. But he really didn't have the tenderness in the right place. He didn't have a fever. And the more I talked to this fellow, and I just sensed his emotional tone, the more I felt that there was something going on here that I really needed to unravel. And so instead of approaching this in a reductive manner, in other words, make it go away, I told him, well, I've got a way of working with these things. Actually, we're going to make your abdomen hurt a little more. And he says, well, if it'll make it better, go ahead. So I thought at least I had a little bit of consent from this fellow. And I pressed on his stomach. And indeed, he did go into sort of a light trance. And he was able to start talking to me, and I started getting more of his story. And he had recently ended a relationship, and he was having a little bit of confusion about his job. But whenever I said anything about his, then I'll usually just check, throw in a father and mother. And boy, when I said anything about his father, his pain just got worse. I mean, he just come up on me. So I back away. So I knew that there was something about his father. And I worked with him for about half an hour, and I just couldn't get close to it. So finally, I just said, well, Peter, I asked the magic question. I says, why don't you tell me just what's going on now that's stirring all this up? And he's going, and then he told me this story. He said that 5 years ago, his father had been diagnosed as having Alzheimer's disease, which is a commonest form of dementia, and had gone downhill quickly and had been put in a nursing home. And this was really traumatic. He said, a brilliant man, a good father, and the whole tragedy of Alzheimer's disease. Well, his dad lived in a nursing home for a couple of years, and then he developed other symptoms, and finally, they figured out that he didn't have Alzheimer's disease. They figured out that he didn't have Alzheimer's disease, but he had a brain tumor. So it was a misdiagnosis. And the man did go ahead and have surgery, and he had a protracted, downhill, terrible course in dying. Well, that kind of explained why this fellow looked like he didn't like doctors when I walked into the room. And I said, well, okay, that was part of it. And then I said again, well, okay, what's going on now? And then he said, in 2 days, I've got to fly to the East Coast, and I've got to stand in my father's place and give my sister away in marriage. And at that point, of course, he had his catharsis, and he cried. And it was most welcome at that time. So he left. He left the office without any pulse, and I went and wrote this up and did some thinking about what was going on here. And I said, before you go, you know, I want you to come back. I really want to do a little work with you and see how things go. Well, of course, he didn't come back right away anyway. But about 3 months later, I opened the door again. I didn't look at the chart. It was just somebody for something minor. And there he was. He was back. Well, I just greeted him like a long-lost friend. As you can see, I mean, I was affected by this experience. Great. And I said, how did the buddy know? He says, it was just wonderful. I felt my father's presence there, and everything was just great. And I started asking him a few more questions. He stopped me and said, but today, Dr. Potter, I just want you to freeze my warts. And so sometimes my enthusiasm is the patient helps me out. Now, I just wanted to end this part of things with a letter from Volume 2 of the Collected Works of Carl Jung. And this letter is written to a man called Frederick Bach. It's dated 5 November 1952. And Herr Bach had written to Jung, encouraging him to write on the spiritual aspect of illness and the encounter it brings with the transcendental. And to Herr Bach, Jung replies, "I am most impressed with your suggestion. That would be the answer a doctor would have to give in order to validate what the doctor has known from time immemorial, or thought he knew. Though I haven't said it, I have at least done it, and so far as my powers allowed me. But it takes more than one lifetime to hold out against the scientific influence in medicine. Your vision is amazingly right, and I marvel. Very sincerely, C.G. Jung." So I'd like to take a break. I do have about maybe 4 or 5 cases that I'd like to present after the break, and hopefully a few questions. Thank you. Case histories, and all these patients have given me permission to use parts of these, and they've been changed enough so that it feels comfortable. And they all illustrate some little point that you'll see. And if I can have the first slide here. And a couple more, just keep going. All right. Now, this lady, at the time I was working with her, was 35. She came to me with problems with depression, and she had one recurrent body illness that had happened 3 times in the last 10 years. And this is her recurring childhood dream. It's kind of an odd-looking thing, and the dream is this, that she is seeing a TV screen with sort of static on it, and all of a sudden it goes absolutely flat. And for some reason it just horrifies her. And now this is a clue to what this illness is, but I often look for recurrent childhood dream with a chronic illness. And there seems to be, like, the dream is almost a predictor of this. So here's her dream. Her first memory is crawling up on a stool or a chair, opening up the freezer, and going for a popsicle, and being face-to-face with what she describes as a giant eye of a giant frozen fish. Next picture, please. Now, this is kind of a negative-looking letter here. And this was a scene from her family that I asked her to do. And here's a mom who, unfortunately, periodically became psychotic and had to go to the hospital, be hospitalized. A father who was a real nice guy but always off into doing his own thing. And a brother who was off doing his own thing but was often setting other little vandalism things. And she became a healthcare provider. Very good-looking girl. And another photo, of course, is mother's hand over her left eye there. Any ideas on what her recurring illness is? Migraine's a good guess. It certainly has something to do with a sudden loss of vision. She had 3 retinal detachments, and a retinal detachment is all of a sudden you just see a curtain come down over your eye. All involved the same eye, the one she had in the picture have to make sure you get the slide right on the left side. And I don't know, to me it just kind of, it more than it was remarkable, that blew me away to see the connections here. Next slide, please. Have another. Now this is a dream of a lady who is about in the late, early 40s. And here's her recurring childhood dream. I'm a helpless, defensive, quivering little rabbit, and I must be absolutely still, hiding in a thicket. And if I'm absolutely still, predators that are circling me will not see me and will go away. And the next slide is her drawing of herself. Well, you can see that either she's not a very good drawer or something has affected her drawing abilities. So, putting this together, you've got a dream that says to be absolutely still. You've got a drawing that's kind of out of proportion and not very correct. Any ideas on the possible illness? I must be absolutely still. Yes, she has MS, multiple sclerosis, with paralysis on one side. She was also in a relationship with an alcoholic person, and she'd have relapses whenever her partner would go tie one on. And so we talked about that and what her relationship was to alcohol personally. And it came to be that when she initially got her disease, and this is not uncommon with MS, that people accuse patients of being drunk. And so we kind of worked on that. And we changed in some way her attitude toward drunkenness. And things did get better for a while. Okay, next slide. And next. A little focusing, maybe. This is a serious drawing. And this is a drawing of a Hodgkin's disease or a cancer of the lymph nodes. The patient is a 35-year-old black male, and he had Hodgkin's disease for 15 years, relapsing, things like that. Now, what's wrong with the picture? Okay, all right, that's good. 35-year-old black male, I don't really see that as being black. Of course, the dragon, he's in deadly combat. This is serious business. And this was hard. His recurring dream is that he falls from a bridge into an industrialized area. And that's his dream. He couldn't tell me any more about that. Well, what came out of it was that this fellow, he'd become a healthcare provider. He'd married a Caucasian. They'd adopted white children. He lived in a white neighborhood, and he went and sang in the choir in a white church. And he looked, talked, and acted very Caucasian. He didn't see this as a problem. Working with him, we came up with an intrapsychic figure called, and this is not my name, but his name, for him, called Tyrone. Now, Tyrone was just the opposite of my patient. And Tyrone loved his black culture, his heritage. He loved being black. The two had to work out more of an equitable agreement about this situation. And at this time, this is 5 years down the line, he's had some recurrences and he's had some chemotherapy, but he's still doing well and he's working. Whether or not my work made a difference, I can't tell you, but I think that this was an interesting part of what was going on. Next picture, please. Okay. This woman is 30, and she has migraine headaches. And she was asked to draw a picture of herself, and she felt good, and she was getting her headaches, and she had them. And here's the picture. She's relaxing, and she feels good. There's a rather ominous cloud up there or something. And this is when she's getting a headache. It's a little bit different. And the next picture, next slide. This is when she's got a headache, and she's had to take pills to knock herself out. This is her experience. Well, let's go back one, please. Now, obviously, the background on this is that she saw me in the walk-in clinic where I'm at. And we talked, and I asked her, we set up an appointment in my other office. We asked her to bring me a picture and of her illness and a dream and things like that that might get stirred up during the week. And she had a heck of a time coming to my office. She had to, I gave her specific instructions, and she had to call, and she was late. She came in there, and it was like she didn't know me, and I wasn't sure I was seeing the same person. And so we were off to a real rocky start. And finally I says, well, did you bring the picture? And she says, what picture? You know, the picture with the crayon. Oh, that's why I went to the drugstore and bought those. Well, to make a long story short, this person is a true multiple personality. And this is not uncommon with chronic migraine, and particularly very difficult migraine. And these two figures represent when the headache's starting, there's a fight for control. And it seems like there's something about this terrible conflict about who's going to do what, and that triggers off the headache. Okay, could we go to the slide after the next one? Okay, now this fellow was about 30, and he came in with an acute bacterial pneumonia, and he was sick. He had a fever, he had a chest x-ray, he had to have some IV antibiotics in the clinic, and as he recovered, I did some work with him. I was seeing him a couple times a week, and I just wanted to see, and he was oriented this way as to what was going on in psyche with this serious illness. Here's a guy 30 years old, and wham, he gets a bad pneumonia that almost puts him in the hospital. Well, I said, bring in a picture. Well, he not only brings me one picture, but he brings me two. And I don't know how well this shows up, but this is the one picture he bought. And I said, well, what's going on here? He says, well, I'm resting, and I'm drinking lots of water. He's got the bottle of water here, and this is all the fluid going into it. Well, I mean, I was kind of lost. Tubular structure, he's in it, easily beats, and he's getting better. So, now the thing that really threw me a curveball was the second picture that he gave me, if you'll give me that. And I said, well, I'm supposed to be pretty good at things, but I just said, well, what's this? And he says, I don't know. He says, I just wanted to give you a different dimension. It looks like a record, but sort of a figure on it, and these two lines here. Well, as he was recovering, I said, well, let's see if we can find out some more. So he went into trance by, again, I'm working with the symptom, just pressing over the area of pneumonia and having to do some breathing. And he sort of began a regression where he got smaller. And he stopped about age 5. And I say, what's going on? And he says, well, you know, I was in the hospital at 5. And I had a severe gastroenteritis. And I couldn't tie that together. I says, well, what else was going on at 5? And he says, oh. He said, I found out then that when I was 2 years old, I had a brother that drowned, an older brother that drowned. And so It was not until 5 that he found out that when he, the patient, was 2, he had a brother who was about 5 or 6 that had drowned. And we started, as he's in this state, working around this brother issue. And believe me, there was a lot of stuff about his brother, a lot of grief, a lot of saying goodbye, a lot of wanting this brother to be around, and sort of a reconnection and a goodbye, and I'm going to be around for you too. And I can't say this drawing has much to do with the drowned brother, but I kind of think it. And although consciously he wasn't telling the story, I didn't know any of this until I worked with him. You've got lungs, and you've got water in the lungs, and you've got pneumonia, you've got a drown, and it certainly all fits together to me. Now the last case is a fellow in his late teens, 19, and he was chronically addicted to marijuana. He was a very restless kid, and I thought that probably he smoked long ago because he was really trying to medicate himself. He had twitchy legs where he just couldn't sit still. And I worked with him by kind of, instead of making his legs twitch more, which made me twitch, I kind of resisted his legs twitching. And he went into trance very profoundly. It was actually the first time that someone had gone into this deep trance. He began to regress, and as he slowly leaned forward, he began to see himself getting smaller. He was, his parents were now divorced. He was the son of an abusive father who used to beat his mama, and he was the oldest of 4 boys, and he had a lot of memories of what was going on, a lot of bad stuff. And he just kept getting smaller as he kept leaning forward. So I just went with it. And he finally got down to about 3, and he began to sob just uncontrollably. And he asked the question, "Why is everything so sad?" And I couldn't answer that question. I mean, I was getting a little bit concerned here. And we just kind of kept working, and I kept hoping that something was going to happen. And I asked him, "Is anybody else around?" And he says, "Well, wait a minute." And by golly, somebody else around. And he says, it's a guy with a chicken head and like Superman's body. And I says, well, who is it? And he says, it's Super Chicken. And boy, I was real glad. And I says, well, what's he doing? He says, he's picking me up, and I'm getting bigger, and he's hauling me out of here. Great. Great. And he made a good bond with Super Chicken, and agreed to be around for him and teach him some things, and that the idea of a chicken and a superhero is not incongruent at all. Well, he came out of his trance, and he's done pretty well. Now, I was thumbing through Stephen Heller's book on the 7 Gospels of Jung, or it's about the Gnostic Gospels, and I did come across just one picture, which I'd like to leave you with for the last slide. And just to show you that Super Chicken is around and is well, anybody recognize this character? This box? All right, well, this is a Gnostic god. It's Abraxas. And Abraxas has the head of a rooster, whole body of a serpent, and whole body of a man. And Abraxas is able to contain both light and dark. A pretty powerful god at that. So, that means that I haven't showed this fellow Abraxas yet, but I'm going to. So that's all the formal things that I have, and if we've got some questions, I'm willing to give it a try. Yeah. Well, the symptom is somehow related, if you can backtrack it, like our drawing here, to that old memory. It's got something to do with the state-dependent memory trying to break into consciousness. So there is this connection. Now, I didn't think this up, but I saw Mark Mandel do this about 6 years ago, and I spent the next 6 years trying to figure out why it happened. And I think this is why it happens. But if you go for the symptom, and this doesn't happen all the time, but oftentimes it's, or sometimes it really works. I just sort of put on as much pressure as it takes to get some sort of a response. I tend to jump way right in there, and the patient will usually tell me too much, and I just kind of let them help me. Well, I think it's a big one. I think the problems of, painful menstrual periods, PMS, recurrent pelvic infections, I think those have strong tie-ups to sexual abuse. I have some experience with that, but not a lot. But I think it's a big one because it's so traumatic and it's so blocked out. I spent 3.5 years with one vet, and the lesson for me in that was that I had to say goodbye. And very difficult. The vets, I think, that have the worst syndrome are the ones that were traumatized and abused before they got there. And then that sets this pattern. And I know more than I want to. And I don't have the answer. Yes. I don't think it's the only one. I think that this gentleman mentioned at least desensitization. And I think there's a lot of therapies that work. There's a lot of therapies that get to this state. This is my particular part of this is my conceptual model of it, and it's been borrowed and stolen from a lot of other things too. But this is just my conceptual model of how it works. I think you can go through a lot of other channels. I think body work can bring this up. I think movement work can bring this up. Visualization can bring it up. Depends on, like, if you're a visualizer, you might, use active imagination. If you're basically a person that's into movement, some Feldenkrais or dance therapy might bring it up. It just depends. So many skins that if I can get through 3 or 4, sometimes I feel pretty good. I try to work short term. As I mentioned with the Vietnam vet, I'm not a trained psychotherapist, and I'm finding what I have to learn is that if it's going to take over 6 or 8 or 10 sessions, that there's some deep issues that are going to take a lot of work, and that then I can make a guided referral to somebody that I think can help with some marriage. So, do I get the architect? Well, that slide's in the room. just that reason, I never really like it. Not all the time, pretty rare at all. Well, it's in its early stages. I generally throw a few rocks at traditional medicine and Dr. Freddie, who's actually a friend of mine up there. But things are opening up, and the younger physicians are more open to this. And I'm now starting to get some, for instance, I have a neurologist now who's starting to refer me some patients. And believe me, that felt pretty good because it was awful slow coming. And I think that it's we're at a paradigm shift or whatever. The old school is still going to be there and it's still got the controls, but people are asking for change. Patients are aware and knowledgeable. So there's a shift. Well, if the symptom is truly related to a dissociated state, it's often a link. In other words, they really start experiencing that symptom and all of a sudden they flip. Their eyes close, their eyelids begin to flutter, their breathing changes, they get maybe a little flush, their body changes. And it's not that. I mean, I probably made it sound like it happens every time. And it's not. It's not that easy. But a trance may just be deep breath, a yawn, your eyes getting a little tired, yeah, huge, like closing. And just doing some breathing, and you're just kind of having an informal talk. But things happen that way that aren't going to happen when you're just up here in the left brain. We're having a traditional conversation. I try to be real general about it. I'd like a picture of you and your pain, and I'd like you to use some colored pens and bigger than a typewriter piece of paper, and just spend about 10 minutes doing it. And in fact, I don't want you to go back and add anything. And that, right. I don't want to tell them much about it because, as you remember some of the drawings, it's like it's real important if the picture doesn't have eyes, or the picture doesn't have ears, or there's no fingers, or there's naked without any genitals, or are they dressed? Where is the symptom, and what color is it? And that tells me a lot, and I know it's a free shot into that symptom, and every time I look at these pictures, I usually see something else that I've missed. Well, early trauma, I mean, let's really say infantile trauma, is probably not processed the same way as later trauma. I mean, it's really far from consciousness. And the person may not, I'd really want to know that person pretty well and tell them that you might have some profound emotions if I just suspect that. It might just come out in a twitch or a convulsion or a shake or a scream and something that doesn't have any words with it. And then I just might say, something's happened, you know what it is? Nope. Did something happen? Yep. Does it matter anymore? No, it's better. Well, that's good enough for me. But that's kind of the concern that crib trauma and things is really hard. You don't have the, you know, any kind of intellectual capacities to do that. You just may have body memory. Well, they're often difficult, and I go back to something I learned in medicine is that you take a history, but you take a little different kind of a history than whether or not you have measles. You take a very detailed history, looking at traumatic events, looking at the moves and things, and you watch very carefully the way the person tells their story. In other words, it's saying, well, you know, when I was 12.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.